and terminated him. Under my leadership, America's policy is unambiguous to terrorists who harm or intend to harm any American. We will find you, we will eliminate you, we will always protect our diplomats, service members, all Americans, and our allies.
That was President Donald Trump Friday explaining America's lethal drone strike attack Thursday on Iranian Quds Forces leader Qasem Soleimani in Baghdad, an event whose repercussions are evolving on a minute-by-minute basis. Hello, everyone. Matt Welch here. Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, featuring Reason's crack editorial team of Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangu Ward. Hello there, peaceniks.
Howdy.
Hey, Matt.
Happy Monday.
We're going to break this situation down five different ways from Sunday. I don't know what that means, but it's a good expression.
Usually it's six
days from Sunday or six ways from Sunday.
Well, you know.
We're only going to do five.
Shocker.
We're not going to do the full six.
Why go six? You know, you know, if you haven't done it in five, you know.
It's a baker's half dozen, Nick, is what I'm going with. Which doesn't make any sense.
That's seven.
Yeah, no.
Well, it's 6.5. We could round it up to seven.
First,
baking is about precision, guys.
Good morning, everyone. We are totally fine and normal.
Just like making cocktails, baking is about precision, and so should this podcast be.
You know, when they, Peter, when they want an advertisement in a podcast, they want it at the top of the show, not before Peter starts talking about cocktails. So, first. Listeners to all Reason podcasts, and that includes, by the way, the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie, should most definitely also check out our friends over at Lions of Liberty, which is one of the oldest and bestest podcasts out there in the libertarian world. They've got three, count them, three weekly shows in their singular feed. These shows are as follows. Their Monday flagship is called Lions of Liberty, which features interviews with the likes of Ron Paul, Gene Epstein, and even a certain leather-jacketed fellow who shall go nameless. Wednesday is a comedic look at culture and current events on something called Electric Liberty Land. And then Felony Friday brings inspiring firsthand tales of those fighting injustice from inside the criminal justice system. You can subscribe to Lions of Liberty anywhere. You can find podcasts and also just go straight to their website, lionsofliberty.com. Awesome. All right. Quick roundup before we try to break this news up into various constituent parts. Elizabeth Nolan Brown recounted this morning at the Reason.com website, which you are all refreshing constantly. The president over the weekend twice threatened to bomb 52 Iranian sites, one for each American hostage taken back before Peter and Catherine were born, I think. This would include non-military targets of great cultural importance. Money, quote, they're allowed to use roadside bombs and blow up our people, and we're not allowed to touch their cultural sites. It doesn't work out that way. Interestingly, Trump, in his full statement from what we listened to before, also explicitly ruled out regime change war in Iran. Defense Secretary Mike Pompeo on Sunday did the full Ginsburg, which, as we all know, is a disgusting sexual act, but it's also a an across the board, Nick says, rubbing his hands. It's across the board appearances on all the Sunday TV chat shows. In them, he continued to insist in various ways that the Soleimani threat was imminent, that his assassination was a defensive measure by the United States, de-escalatory in nature, and that the U.S. long-term is dedicated to reducing and not increasing its military footprint in the region, despite the fact that in the short term, very much the opposite is happening. The Iraqi parliament passed a resolution, apparently lacking much force, but still pretty symbolic, calling for the expulsion of U.S. troops there, to which the president threatened sanctions like they've never seen before unless the Iraqis pay us back for our efforts there.
Now, that's to a country that, within recent memory, faced pretty severe U.S. sanctions.
I kind of remember those
right,
sanctions.
Matt? I believe your first big piece for Reason was actually talking about Iraqi sanctions.
Indeed, Mr. Gillespie. And we also have some action in both the Senate under Tim Kaine and the House. Nancy Pelosi are announcing intentions to push through a War Powers Resolution vote about this whole thing. The president is claiming that his Twitter feed is legally satisfactory enough in terms of notifying Congress. And then also there was a gigantor funeral for Soleimani in Iran. So sorry for that longer than usual windup. Catherine, let's start on the kind of narrow question and then move out broader. The War Powers Act from 1973 says that the president can only initiate armed hostilities in case of, quote, national emergency created by attack upon the United States, its territories or possessions, or its armed forces, unquote. It further requires the commander-in-chief to notify Congress within 48 hours of initiating or launching said emergency activities. So knowing what we know so far, which is always very foggy, did President Trump, in the judgment of Catherine Mangu Ward, comply with or violate the War Powers Act?
Well, on Saturday, he delivered the formal notification to Congress, which is, I think, totally, you know, it's totally classified. We have no access to that document. Nancy Pelosi has characterized it, saying this document prompts serious and urgent questions about timing, manner, and justification of the administration's decision to engage in hostilities in Iran. Like, she just means like he wrote something on a post-it note and like dropped it in Nancy Pelosi's mailbox or something. But technically, he has complied, I think. The part that's a little more confusing is
the tweet. He posted some of it on Twitter, right?
Right. So, but the part that's a little more confusing is the tweet in which he says, so my favorite Donald Trump tweets, by the way, are the ones that use like a kind of quasi-formal language. Like when it's like, he sometimes is like, I should tweet this like I'm the king. And so it's these media posts, capitalized, will serve as notification to the United States Congress. And then it's, you know, and then he says such legal notice is not required, but is given nonetheless. So that's where things start to get a little confusing. Does he now believe that he has served all notification going forward under the War Powers Act? Is he sort of saying like done and dusted? Presumably he is referring to the fact that some have claimed this type of notification is not necessary since any action in Iran is covered under pre-existing authorizations of use of force. That is a sentiment not shared by many congressmen, including Jared Huffman of California, who I will confess never heard of before today, who was quoted in the Washington Post saying, OMG, Trump thinks a crazed tweet satisfies his War Powers Act obligations to Congress. Our president has taken us to the brink of war and is now vamping, which I love. Great
that
use of the word vamping.
Comforting.
With
comforting
no
that
plan, no clue. Please, someone in the GOP, take the car keys, read the 25th Amendment. So I would say that's a vibe. That's a big mood that's happening on the Hill.
OMG.
OMG. Vamping.
That's comforting.
But I want to end with my personal favorite tweet from Mark Pocan, a Democrat in Wisconsin, who I've also not heard of until today. At Real Donald Trump, this is Twitter. This is not where you wage unauthorized wars.
This is a proper place to wage unauthorized wars.
Sorry,
so
Mark.
This is a good moment, though, to go, and assuming that these are actual congressmen. Yeah. And that they
I checked.
Were in
I actually did check
when,
that because okay. I was like, you know what? I don't want to get like Shoshana Weissman here. Like, I don't want, because, you know, her, her Twitter account is Senator Shoshana, and she regularly posts screenshots of people like being mad at her for not using conduct becoming of a congressman. So these are real congressmen.
Yeah. And over the weekend, there was a brief challenger, a fake challenger to Nancy Pelosi named Cliff Eastwood, who has been taken down off of Twitter, but who announced that he was claiming to be the Republican running against her. It's very funny. But assuming they're real, I'm curious if any of them were in office when Obama was also doing unconditional or acts of war where he didn't even bother going through the procedures of the War Powers Act. Or in fact, when Trump, if we remember back in 2017, when he did the missile strike against Syria and people such as Fareed Zakaria said, I think Donald Trump became president today. And none of this obviates from the fact that this is a stupid action, and it underscores, you know, with super indelible gold markers or whatever Trump does to you, you know, what to notate the emails that get printed out because he's too 20th century to even know what email is, that we shouldn't be in the Middle East, that when the country that we supposedly helped save Iraq decided to kick us out, we probably should have listened to the democratically elected government, that our whole mission there was supposed to be about bringing into reality and into existence. But Trump once again is clarifying how full of shit most people are, because there are numbers of people who thought he was presidential when he bombed Syria, or when Obama did stuff like that brave strike against Libya that worked out so well. You know, this, I mean, we need to use, as libertarians, we need to use the Trump moment to kind of put a button and a bow on all of the bullshit that has proceeded right up until this moment, and start, and I hate to sound like Himmler in Man in the High Castle, but we need a year zero where we acknowledge our tribalism and our bullshit and start moving forward with some clarity and some honesty of purpose.
Before leaving the legalism of it, because I think it is kind of interesting to chew on some bits, I want to throw this to Suderman as a...
But note the legalism. He has satisfied the legal terms of the War Powers Act.
Well, I'm not sure about that, because the 48 hours, to me, it's unclear, and I'm just confessing my ignorance out loud of whether that begins from the time somebody eats a bomb, or that the bombing mission is authorized, right? So, that's part of where the congressional notification aspect, he's usually supposed to notify the Gang of Eight in Congress of eight senior leaders beforehand, and didn't traditionally. Traditionally, that's what you're supposed to do. I don't know if that is statutorily the same thing as the 48-hour notification. But he then retweeted a Dinesh D'Souza tweet saying, well, of course you wouldn't notify Chuck Schumer, because that's the same as notifying Iran. So I'm not sure whether it complies. But there's another element to this that potentially would bolster Trump's case that he did on paper comply, and I want Suderman to get in there on this, which is that, let's assume for the moment, and I think it's a plausible assumption, that Soleimani had his fingerprints over the attack on the U.S. embassy in Iraq, in Baghdad, of a few days before, which is definitely the escalatory pre-thing that happened before this did.
Pretext.
Thank
pretext.
You.
Pretext.
Or that's another pre-word. But anyways.
Condition.
The inciting incident.
Thank you. Precipitating. Hello. Assuming that he did have his fingerprints on this thing, which was an attack on, as the War Powers Act says, this is a U.S. asset, then aren't you justified, Peter Suderman, in finding the dude who attacked us and blowing him up?
I think if that's the case, then that makes the legal rationale stronger. But it's not entirely clear that's the case. And as you wrote conveniently and helpfully last Friday, administrations lie often about justifications for going to war or using military force. And if you look through the kind of the TikToks that have been published here, in which reporters talk to people in the administration, in Trump's orbit, in the administration, about how exactly this went down, I think what's pretty clear is that the process on this was not great. It was rushed. It appears to have happened, just sort of over the course of maybe a couple of hours at most. There wasn't a lot of deliberation on this,
which does collapse the timeline, Matt, for your concern about, does the clock start when they decide to do it or when they do it? Well, if those two times are only a couple hours apart, then...
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so Trump was in the middle
of some other
meetings and just kind of dropped out for a little bit. They presented him with a suite of options. And this is another thing that we learned, is that the decision making, he went with the most extreme option, the one that he wasn't supposed to pick. Now, this is... I think it doesn't look great for the military officials who presented him with an option that he was not supposed to pick. That's not a good idea for, say, the guy who had to be talked down from building an alligator moat around the,
But this is also standard negotiation psychology, right? Like you.
But Trump doesn't respond
it
to
isn't.
Standard negotiation
it isn't. And it's
psychology.
Not. Yeah. And it's and not is, negotiation. It is, right. It's part of the fucking administration.
Right.
I mean, this is what drives me nuts about this whole thing, is now suddenly we're talking about how the New York Times reported, and it's devastating, that, you know, the military leaders, you know, who are kind of anti-Trump, right? Because even though they serve for him and they are directly responsible for the past 20 years of complete clusterfucks,
of American foreign policy and war strategy were supposed to be sympathetic because they didn't really mean it when they tacked this on a list of options that they give to the president, who they know is like unhinged. We're talking about this so wrongly.
Is a bad decision maker, as it's pretty clear many senior military officials do, then don't give him an option to do something that you think would be a bad idea. So
yeah,
that,
but,
I think you can blame.
Why
Trump
are you
to some
assuming?
Extent.
Why are you assuming that the military? Why are you assuming that the military leaders, where the military leaders are not the first order problem, you know, or co-equal with Trump? You know, this is the thing that I think we need to get to, and it's interesting to me, or it's not interesting. Nick. It's actually kind of great that Bernie Sanders is about the only presidential candidate who is out there in full force saying, you know what, I was against all of these wars and I'm against this action here. Let's have a discussion about that rather than starting to do Kremlinology on a military industrial complex that has covered itself in, you know, in just vomit for our entire adult lives.
Yeah. Sorry. So what I was trying to say was that I believe there is co-equal blame, and that the Pentagon officials who gave Trump an option he wasn't supposed to pick, while also believing that he's kind of a bad decision maker, an erratic person who doesn't really know what he's doing, and tends to fly off the handle, that's a bad idea. And they deserve blame for doing that. And so we have a decision-making process that was rushed, that was extreme, and then at the end, that was also political. And the other thing that the reporting has outed here is that Trump appears to have been reacting to negative press coverage when he called off a strike previously, and people called him weak, and people thought that he was, you know, sort of a weak decision maker because it had been something that was going to go through. And at the very last minute, he learned about the number of casualties that were likely and said, no, we're not going to go do this. And then you combine that with the fact that Trump has a longstanding history, starting in 2011, basically accused President Obama of wanting to go to war in order to win elections. And so in Trump's mind, there's pretty good reason to believe that he thinks that going to war and that acting aggressively in, you know, foreign affairs is something that will help him win an election. And I think that is a big mistake on his part. I think it's a very bad way to go about making a decision like this. And what you see from the process is that it was messed up every which way. It was messed up in the White House, in the presidency, but also in the Pentagon, and also in the people who are responsible for executing for all of this, for presenting the president with options. This is a near perfect example of how badly messed up the military industrial complex is in the United States, as well as the political process that controls it, with Donald Trump obviously being at the center of that.
Catherine, Nick kind of hinted at it in a half a second, in terms of, hey, you know, why not impeach the president here? Justin Amash tweeted out in response to the president's assertion of media posts and whatnot. He tweeted out, this Constitution of the United States of America will serve as notification to the president that should he order non-defensive strikes without congressional approval, he will be in violation of the law. Such legal notice was provided in 1789, but is given here again, nevertheless. Amash's Twitter game remaining strong. Is this an impeachable offense if he blows up a culturally important mosque to retaliate against something?
I think this gets us back to something we've talked about on this podcast before, which is the thing that is currently at issue, the things that are currently at issue in the impeachment proceedings, which are restarting as we speak. They're not the worst things that Donald Trump did. That's not what impeachments are. It's not what's the worst thing this president did. That's, you know, I think most relevantly and notably true in this case, in terms of a historic parallel with Nixon, but you can see it in almost every impeachment, that it's always been kind of a weird technicality, some kind of thing that the relevant congressmen think will be able to generate consensus. So I don't know. Maybe this is impeachable. Maybe it's not. But it doesn't really matter, because this is not the kind of thing people get impeached over, I don't think. The explicit announcement of the intention to go after cultural sites does kind of shock my sensibilities. And, you know, the facts don't care about my feelings and all that. But that does seem to be purposely crossing a line, or maybe not purposely crossing a line, because we always do have to entertain the possibility that Donald Trump didn't really know that particular line was there. That this sort of respect that we accord to cultural sites is an artifact of kind of an artificial but longstanding agreement between nations, encoded but not super, super clearly in every case as a kind of war crime, but kind of not, depending on which document you're looking at. Certainly, clearly, as something we ought not do.
So he may not have known the legal line, but he clearly meant this to shock your sensibilities.
He meant it to be a serious threat and to shock not my sensibilities necessarily, but
I think
like
he was aiming that tweet at you, mostly, Catherine Mangu Ward.
Mostly, yeah, Iran. I though actually want to get back just for a quick second to the "we're not leaving unless they pay us back for it" line, because that to me
that
is
sounds bad. Honestly,
it's such
like I'm worried about the payback that it's
yeah,
not.
First of all, like they'll pay us back for it. You better believe. But also, it's just such an interesting look into the mindset of interventionists, right? You know, the idea that a base in your country, an air base in your country would be a gift, like that it's something that people should be grateful for, that it's something that they would owe us compensation for if we abandoned it and left it there. It's such a different mindset than I think people in the region typically have. And it reminds me of like when people quarrel with their extremely toxic parents or step parents and they say like, well, you're going to have to pay me back for all the money I spent raising you. It's such a crazy thing to say, but it has this like little teeny bit of plausibility if you're looking at the world through a totally distorted lens. And I would be very interested in like a poll question that asks whether that's a reasonable thing to say or not. Because I wonder, maybe America's like, yeah, they should pay us back. We built them that real nice base.
I bet at least a few would. I want to suggest quickly a small difference on the impeachment question, which is that if Congress believes that Trump is in the wrong with this attack on an Iranian military official, Congress has a recourse, which is
the
that
war
they can
acts.
Say, we can't go to war.
Right.
That's it. When it comes to
they're not going to do that.
Correct. They're not going
but
to.
But they have recourse so, that's not impeachment.
Right. And so they have a recourse that is they can stop the president. They can go through a process and they're not going to do that. And that's why he's not going to be impeached over that. When Trump does a shady deal with Ukraine that's about, 2020 politics, the recourse Congress has is impeachment. And so that's an important distinction there. And
yeah,
if Trump were to say, follow through on attacks after Congress had voted to not allow them, then the next step would be impeachment. But because Congress isn't going to do the first step, we're not going to get to impeachment over something like this, even if you think it is. And I agree, this certainly if it leads to a major war, it's much worse.
It's not going to happen because recent presidents have all done exactly this. And Congress they're a bunch of whining babies who refuse to actually perform their constitutional functions. There are people like Justin Amash who are, resolute in calling for this stuff. And they were unheard, whether it's a Republican president or whether it's a Democratic president, because Congress ultimately doesn't want to be responsible. And I think this moment, which is clarifying because it shows in all of its glory how awful Donald Trump's decision-making process is on the most kind of fundamental, foundational, and possibly earth-changing dimensions that the president can affect. The actions can affect. He is awful on this, and he is acting exactly like Obama did and George Bush did. And neither side at that point wanted to call things out. Or what I think we need to look at this moment not as something about the Trump presidency, but as the closing act of a much larger set of actions that have been going on for the past 20 years and that are disastrous. And we have to go back. Hillary Clinton testified before Congress after Libya that, Obama didn't need to invoke the War Powers Act at all, which, by the way, has also never been fully vetted. It's not clear that it's fully legal. It's never been challenged at the highest levels in the American judiciary. But she said he didn't have to do that and he doesn't have to now, et cetera. It's like, let's hold her accountable and the forces that she represents. Let's hold the hawks who were saying this when Democrats were sniping after the Iraq war went south pretty quickly that George Bush was being a bad guy, et cetera. But then when their guy did it, they didn't care. Like, we need to be looking at this and taking a much, much bigger lesson than Trump is an idiot. Trump is bad. Trump should be impeached. Trump should be not be reelected, et cetera. Because this situation is it existed long before Trump, and it will exist long after if we don't actually learn the right lesson.
I went back.
This specific situation, I don't think. There are certainly parallels, but this specific situation, both Bush and Obama went through a process where they were presented, where they discussed the option of taking out Soleimani and decided not to because they believed that it would spark a larger war. And so if you have a better process and executives who are better at making decisions,
Peter,
you do avoid some of these bad decisions, not all of them, and that's not a justification.
Peter, we are in Iraq after
Obama
being told
and
to
George
leave.
W. Bush made. But it is to say that in this specific instance, they saw this as
that,
a bad
you are
idea.
Dancing.
That was, they saw this particular action as a bad idea that was likely to spark a major conflict that would make Americans less safe, and they chose not to take it because they had a better process and they were better at making decisions.
I submit that you are dancing on the head of a pin with that. Talking about this, like, are you fucking kidding? You know, Trump, by the way, Trump deserves a moment of praise for saying on the debate stage with the Republican Party, and this is one of the reasons why Jeb Bush disappeared. He said, your brother lied us into the Iraq war. We are living in a moment now where we understand all of this. All of this is pure power politics. This has nothing to do with principle. It has nothing to do with anything other than momentary gain, in a political process. And I'm not talking about you, Peter, or anybody on this podcast. What I'm saying is this, you know, we need to not be drawn into, oh, well, you know what, the process on killing this particular guy was a little bit shitty this time, but it was a little bit better under Obama and Bush had this. No, it's like we need to look at the big picture and not get drawn into like these tiny details, which we can, you know, freaking argue over until Armageddon or until, you know, what's most likely happen is there may or may not be a reprisal. And we'll continue going on. And whoever takes over, like, look at what are the foreign policy options of who's going to be president in 2024? It's either going to be Trump or somebody other than Tulsi Gabbard and possibly Bernie Sanders. And we're going to have exactly the same foreign policy problems unless we really focus on, you know, recognition, public acknowledgement, and an enforcement of a different mentality as to how the U.S. is going to engage the world.
I would
Bernie
submit
Sanders
that
is
this
is doing better than you than people think.
If everyone would just shut the fuck up for a half a second here, thank you. I would submit that there is an important distinction that's being lost in this discussion and in the broader discussion here, which is that there is a difference between regime change wars and non-regime change wars. A very, very important big style difference, and it's important. Or at least noteworthy that Trump explicitly ruled out in his statements talking about this regime change war in Iran. I don't know if that's going to end up being true in the long term or not. We did engage in regime change war in Libya explicitly, even though the original idea for that, which was also shown to be a steaming pile of crap, was that we did it to prevent an imminent massacre in Benghazi. Of all places, all right. We did regime change war in Iraq, to incredibly disastrous consequences. And at the same time, it is true. Peter is right that the last two presidencies looked at this very option with Soleimani and ruled against it. I think one thing that people are getting wrong, and it's infuriating to me to read, and sometimes I read this in our own orbits and elsewhere, like people are still so mad at Maureen Dowd for writing a column in the New York Times before the 2016 election saying that Hillary was the warmonger and Trump was the comparative peacenik, and they're saying, aha, now this proves that this was all wrong. Well, we're forgetting that there's a category in American foreign policy history and thinking. It's called Jacksonianism. right? It's named after Andrew Jackson. Andrew Jackson was not a nation builder. He was kind of a nation destroyer if it got to it, or if you got into his grill, he would light a flamethrower on you, right? Trump has been this way from the beginning. He's been against, as Nick rightly points out, regime change war based on lies. He's right about that. At the same time, he's been objectively pro-war crime every fucking day of his life, or at least since he's been trying to go for it. He tells a story on the stump, a totally made-up story about Blackjack Pershing dipping bullets in pig's blood in the Philippines and shooting a Muslim and saying, go back to your villages, and then tell us to cross America. Again, this is he pardoned a war criminal and feeded him at Mar-a-Lago. Absolutely disgusting act from a president. So the cultural sites thing, it's not an aberration. Absolutely not. This is what he does. It's an entire history of foreign policy. It's a tradition that says, hey, look, we're going to be sort of irritable, irascible, unpredictable nationalists. We don't like your international kind of structures. If you come close to us, it's going to be fire and fury. But at the same time, we're going to rule these things out. And I think not looking at that as a category of thing obscures our argumentation for this a lot and just causes for a lot of pointless confusion of trying to analyze what the president is or isn't going to do next. And I'm just going to say before I end the thought that I went back as part of this and sort of looked at September 2016, pretty interesting month for both the presidential debate and particularly what Nick was referring to with Hillary Clinton in Libya. That month, there was a super long, super detailed, and super damning report by the British Parliament looking at the Allied case for war in Libya. And it just said this was trumped up, cherry-picked intelligence. They didn't know what they were doing. They had a lack of basic intel on the ground. They didn't at all pay attention to possible repercussions. They didn't. They downplayed any sense that there was this Islamists that they were going to be emboldening as part of this process. Well, September 2016 was also notable in foreign policy, political discourse, and coverage, media coverage in this country, in that that report was almost not talked about. We talked about it at Reason. A couple other people mentioned it. Basically, saying that a major presidential candidate, this was her signature move as Secretary of State, like, you know, helping convince Obama, who was somewhat on the fence of it at the time, saying, no, we got to do this thing. She was still bragging on it, a smart power at its best. And they're saying this was all BS. That's not what got coverage in September 2016. What got coverage that month in foreign policy and presidential politics was that Gary Johnson didn't recognize the word Aleppo. I swear to God, that's what people paid attention. If you look back and just measured the NexusLexus search of hits for both those two stories, Aleppo is going to outdistance it by a factor of 10 to 1, I promise you. And that, to me, shows how absolutely blinkered we are in these moments and in all moments, because people want to go to, towards Nick's point, the political scrum of the day, the way that people are talking about stuff, the kind of headline political crap, and don't look even a half a step back. Even 1 month ago, we were talking about the Afghanistan papers, 18 consecutive years of lying to Americans about the war that we're still in. Right. And we're still in.
To the extent.
Can I give that a slow clap? Just like.
Yeah.
No. To the extent like the that spin, the current the moment, the current moment calls to mind the 60s, both before and after, you know, kind of the Great Society and the kind of counterculture exploded in a period of economic expansion, but a deep sense of foreboding. And Matt, you know, the parallels which you and other people at Reason drew between the Pentagon Papers and the Afghanistan report that was done, you know, I mean, we need to, like, can we finally learn something from history and alter the future even a little bit? Because this, the foreign policy stuff is absolutely terrifying, because this is, we just keep coming back to the same point on the circle. And like, can we at least get on a slightly different timeline for this stuff? That would be so uplifting and optimistic.
Catherine, I'll let you have the last word on this topic, sitting as you have been on the sidelines. And if you prefer, you can just say which of the anti-Trump action commentary, right? There's a lot of hyphens there. From someone who's either in the resistance or a never Trumper, made you so basically commentary agreeing with you that maybe this wasn't a good idea. Nevertheless, made you want to put your claws on a chalkboard.
I want to go the other way, actually, and say that one thing that these last few days has reminded me is how very limited the common cause can be between libertarians and conservative never Trumpers. And we've been reminded of that a bit with the revival of the war on porn, everyone's favorite. But
although the war on porners are in many cases pro Trump or at least anti Trump.
But there are plenty of never Trumpers who would happily, you know, saddle up for the war on porn. But in terms of,
so to speak,
fuck you, in terms of foreign policy, you know, I subscribe to all of these new Never Trump newsletters and publications and podcasts and all these things, and they were overwhelmingly absolutely party line. He was an evil man. He killed Americans. This was the right thing to do. This is a show of strength. Just a very, very conventional line that springs from the conservative affection for military action as a general matter, and also for shows of strength in more than just military forms. But I certainly was in a couple of different conversations in the last few days where those people's support for this action was making generally anti-war people doubt their kind of gut impulse on this. They were saying, like, wait a minute, these guys are our friends. They're saying this one actually made sense. Maybe this was the right thing to do. And I think this is a good study in a more subtle form of tribalism that takes place in Washington. When you start to think of people who have fundamentally different ideologies from your own as part of your team, you give their arguments greater weight, and that can be dangerous. There is an ad hoc coalition now between some conservatives who oppose Donald Trump and many, many people on the left. That coalition will disintegrate and probably should disintegrate. And in the meantime, we should be careful not to take their word that this was the right thing to do as evidence of anything other than a pre-existing commitment to war, to the value of war, to the value of using military force on a relatively, you know, a relatively light trigger. That those are not our principles. Those are not my principles, at least. And it's important to frame up any debate not as pro-Trump, anti-Trump, but as pro-war, anti-war. And we should be anti this war, I think, very clearly, and maybe anti all wars. But we don't need to have that fight. We can just have the be anti this war fight and have it at least to some extent separate from the pro or anti-Trump question.
So, Nick, I remember when Rand Paul was running for president and trying to sketch on this is in the against the backdrop of Americans getting beheaded by ISIS and him feeling like he had it to sound at least somewhat plausible to a more mm-hmm. hawkish GOP. He said that, well, I support military intervention when it's used to defend our diplomatic territories abroad. Say this because, you know, again, there was a recent attack on the U.S. embassy. Thomas Massie, friend of Rand Paul, tweeted out over this past weekend a reminder that the $1 billion, 100-acre U.S. embassy in Iraq is the biggest in the world. It is about five times the size of the U.S. embassy in the second biggest place, which is Yerevan, obviously. He describes it as a colossal monument to failed neocon adventurism.
Oh, it's the Ozymandias sculpture.
Meant to serve
as
the world's largest boat anchor, cementing American military and political presence in the Middle East against Americans' wishes. Kind of like it's the ultimate sort of a honey trap, or boat anchor is probably a better metaphor since it's
let's use boat anchor.
Let's use honey anchor. How about honey anchor?
That would not be effective.
So what is your solution to the conundrum, Nick, of we have gigantic both bases and embassies in places that are quasi failed states that tend to hate us? Should we just like dismantle that damn thing and get the hell out?
They have to pay us back for it first.
Well, you know, a trumpet also mused about, which was something that, you know, proponents of war in Iraq talked about when it started, that this was all going to be a money-making venture, you know, because we would sell off Iraqi oil after that started flowing again. So we would end up in a net positive. Not only would we get rid of Saddam Hussein and stabilize the entire Middle East, but we would make money doing it. Yeah, we need to actually have a I'm stumbling over the word or stammering over saying conversation, but this is the moment where we need to, you know, among America, because none of this stuff, we're not even talking about how it actually will influence or impact things in the Middle East. There is every reason to believe, you know, that this may have an effect on the Iranian regime, which is ultimately salutary, whatnot. That isn't what we're talking about here. What we're talking about is, as Americans, there is a deep consensus where the trigger is, it's always a light trigger finger, and the predisposition is to invade countries. This is something that we've been doing since at least World War II. Times have changed. Things have changed. Trump, in many ways, articulated some of the reasons for that and kind of like evoked why we shouldn't be the world's policeman and everywhere. He has gone back on his word, or he doesn't understand what he's talking about. But more importantly, there are all of these forces within the American power structure that absolutely exist solely on the idea that we will always be the indispensable nation, and we will have bases in dozens and dozens of countries, and we will always be setting up tripwires. Yeah, we need to pull out of this stuff. The Obama and Leon Panetta tried to keep American forces in Iraq after the government told us to go scratch. They were attacked by interventionists. I don't think neocon is a meaningful term anymore, but hawks and interventionists for pulling out somewhat according to the wishes of the Iraqi government, which supposedly represented the will of the people we had come to save. We need to do more of that. We don't need to be places where we're told we're not welcome.
All right, let's shift gears. I'm sure that Iran and relations will be with us for many Mondays to come. But we just celebrated January 1st, some of us while working the poll in firehouses in Red Hook. But that, yeah.
Which of us would that be?
Nick, mostly.
I didn't even know there was a poll there. Matt. Matt is actually the one last seen. And it's a fire poll. It's a fire poll, not a stripper poll. So
I think January 1st, it's too early. I don't believe in polls that early.
Okay.
Thanks, Stephanie.
Wow. Yes. At any rate, a lot of laws change on the 1st of January. Some are good. Many, perhaps most, are bad. And so we want to do a quick lightning round amongst the assembled personages to name a single law that went to effect on January 1st that you find noteworthy of discussion. Catherine Megan Ward, do you want to lead the class?
Yeah, I want to talk about red flag laws, which have been growing in popularity. There was one that went into effect in Colorado on the 1st. It has sparked a bunch of opposition, including a bunch of cities saying that they are now sanctuary cities. The idea of a red flag law is that it allows either, in the case of Colorado, it allows either family members or close associates of a person who owns firearms to put a red flag next to someone's name, essentially to ask that law enforcement come and confiscate those firearms preemptively because they believe that the person might be a harm to themselves or others. In some states, this is just a tool of law enforcement. In Colorado, it was sold aggressively as a way to let family members protect themselves, to be a kind of first line of defense against domestic violence and other uses of firearms. I think it's telling, though, that the very first use of this law, which happened hours after it went into effect, was just a use by law enforcement. So, you know, I think there are a couple things going on that are not good. One is to sell a law as something that empowers people, but actually have it be something that empowers law enforcement is not great. Also, in Colorado, as Jacob Sullum has reported, baked into the assumptions of the law are that 95% of these red flag requests will be granted in the fiscal projections about how much the law is going to cost to enforce. They just assume these are going to be rubber stamped. What this starts to look like to me is a very broad authorization to confiscate people's guns. It also looks like a flashpoint for violence, because the whole idea here is that the police show up at your house, previously unannounced and say, give us your guns, which if the person is already unstable or prone to violence, is not going to end well and is already in places where these laws are have already kicked in or is not ending well. I think that it's a pretty dangerous abridgment of Second Amendment rights. I think it's, you know, creepy preemptive policing. And I think that it passed in Colorado largely because it was sold as a victim's rights type dealy, when in fact it is just an expansion of law enforcement powers.
Peter, which new law are you either red flagging or green flagging?
I want to red flag California's AB5, which has gotten a lot of attention. It's a very bad law that is intended. It has good intentions, right? Which is that, there's the gig economy has all of these workers who are contractors. They're doing work that is fundamental to a company's business. Shouldn't they be full-time employees with benefits? The law mandates that in many cases they have to be. In particular, it says that freelance journalists who contribute more than 35 articles a year to a publication have to be treated as full-time employees, not as contractors. So 35 articles a year is less than one column a week. There, if you know anything about the business of journalism, lots of columnists are contractors who are paid on a per article basis, and many of them write once or twice a week, or in some cases, for some publications, they write several times a day, even dozens of articles per week, and that's how the system works, and that allows writers to be more flexible about their schedule. It allows publications to sort of to use people when they need them and not at the rest of the time. It allows writers to work for multiple publications at once. And what the California law says is that if you do more than 35 for one outlet, that outlet has to treat you as a full-time employee. So guess what? Here is a headline from the Los Angeles Times. Vox Media, which owns properties such as Vox.com, but also a bunch of other websites, Vox Media cuts hundreds of freelance journalists as AB5 changes loom. That's from just a couple of months ago. From last month in December. Totally predictable that is what would happen, that media outlets would look at that and say, well, we just can't employ or can't easily employ freelance work writers in California. And so this law that was supposed to help people, that was designed to counteract what the lawmakers believed were negative effects of the gig economy, is actually going to cost a lot of freelance writers their jobs.
This has, by the way, helped kind of gut a site that was a longtime favorite of mine called Halo's Heaven, an Angels baseball website. And this makes me very, very sad. Nick, what law are you paying attention to?
In a counterintuitive disappointment, in Ohio, Ohio exempted tampons and other menstrual-related products from sales tax, which joining about a dozen other states that exempt this type of product from sales tax, general sales tax, because they're considered necessities rather than luxury goods. And in general, I think libertarians cheer whenever a tax is reduced or a loophole is created. It means people are paying less tax. What for this, and it's not so much about this, but it's about the insanity of the way that sales taxes are levied throughout the country. And I immediately repaired to the latest update of my home state of New Jersey, which in 2008 clarified what it charges sales tax on. And you see quickly how the sales tax, which is supposed to be a universally applied tax in order to raise revenue for the things that government does, which is what it should be. And most economists actually prefer consumption taxes or sales taxes that are universal, but that are generally low in rate, as not distorting economic decision making, not engaging in social engineering by saying, hey, if you buy this rather than this, you get a special perk, et cetera. It's a good idea. Preferable if when we have taxes, it's better that they're consumption taxes and they're universal. But you get into these situations where the government starts saying this is a luxury and this is a necessity, and we'll change the sales thing. From a libertarian point of view, all things should be taxed equally because the government should be valued neutral in what it claims is a necessity or a luxury for life in these United States. And in New Jersey, for instance, Matt, I was thinking of you. Athletic shoes that have cleats or spikes are taxed under the sales tax, whereas running shoes or jogging shoes are not. And that's these are completely...
Stand.
It's just, you know, this is why, you know, this is like we need a Shays rebellion against this kind of stuff.
Well, it kind of is.
So, like, but running is not, or running shoes, jogging is not. And you go through the lists of what gets taxed and what doesn't. And this also harkens back to an early Reason column. This was long before I worked at the magazine, but they were talking about the insanity of sales taxes because once you levy a sales tax, that's one thing. And then once you say certain goods are exempt from it, then you need a commission that goes through all of the new products that are introduced at any given month, any given year, and say, well, this is a luxury, this isn't. And it would get to a point where things like scouring pads, Brillo, you know, and whatnot, if it had soap impregnated in it, that became a luxury good, but regular steel wool wasn't. And you have like a whole infrastructure deciding this. And it's just, I think, a shorthand for why we want the government to be, you know, we need government for certain things. I'm an anarchist. I'm not an anarchist. I'm a libertarian. But you want to, But you want it to be as minimal and as untime consuming and as, you know, kind of expansionary as possible. Let's go with sales taxes that are universal, allow markets to function with minimal distortions. And then people who need help paying for stuff, because they're poor or they, you know, they can't fend for themselves, give them subsidies that they can use in the form of unrestricted cash grants. I think this solves virtually all of the shit that we talk about, whether we're talking about the cost of college, the cost of housing, the cost of healthcare. We have mostly functioning markets and all of these things and food. Just give them, you know, give people who can't participate in markets enough money so they can in a meaningful way that they can build their lives and kind of fulfill themselves. But don't screw it up for all the rest of us. So that's what I'm thinking about.
The law that I'm looking at for this next year, because it will be used as a model or at least looked at very closely, its successes or failures, is right here in the great state of New York, the Empire State. Changed its criminal justice system, eliminating about 90% of cash bail. So most people who are arrested for a crime will not be going behind bars in order to fulfill a bail requirement going forward. This has a lot of civil libertarians, including our own Scott Shackford, pretty happy. New York law enforcement is apoplectic about this, as are the, you know, Manhattan Institute type of analysts there. Another part of it is also that now prosecution in cases have to share the information that they have gleaned with defense in cases 15 days within either 15 days of getting it or 15 days before trial or something. It's a big, it's a large change. I'm looking at this closely because there already are kind of counter politics happening with the increase locally of anti-Semitic attacks. At least one of the recent anti-Semitic attackers in New York is someone who had been recently released on without cash bail. And so Bill de Blasio and others are making politics about this. New York has a very weird combination of progressive impulses on the grassroots and on the voting level and kind of progressively authoritarian instincts on policing, which anything from cigarette taxes to cigarette task forces and stop and frisk and the whole nine yards. And so these things are coming at conflict here. There's a sense in law enforcement that this is going to be the bridge too far. We're going to have rapists and murderers on the loose and crime is going to go up. These same people have been making these predictions since the end of stop and frisk, and it has been wrong up until now. So it'll be fascinating to watch going forward. I think on a large part, it is a positive move. I think a lot of the bail system here in New York has been structured to shake down poor people in a way that's unseemly and wrong and unjust. And I think that will do good things about ending that. But we shall see where it goes forward. All right. So enough of January 1st, new laws. What have you all been consuming in terms of cultural products? Catherine?
I know we've already talked about this, so I will keep it brief, but Watchmen. Oh my God. Watchmen is so freaking good. I'm dying. It's so good.
How far are you?
I'm only on the fourth episode.
Oh man.
And it gets better.
It's so good. I have nothing more to say. I know we've already talked about it, but that's all that's in my brain. It's like 20% War with Iran, 80% Watchmen.
Remind readers what your relationship with the original graphic novel is, if any.
I read it.
Reader, listeners.
I read it. I'm not a fan. I'm not like a stan of the Watchmen verse, but I appreciate its place in the canon. I consumed it probably, I don't know, 10 years ago in its sort of collected, not individually, but like in the collected final form all at once.
As a graphic novel.
As a graphic novel, in fact, and very much enjoyed it and respected its artistry, but was like, all right, I got it. But OMG, this show.
How do you feel about squid?
I like to eat it. But okay. If it vanishes after 30 seconds, then it doesn't do any good.
Nick, what have you been consuming?
I am currently reading a recent book by Stephen Kinzer called Poisoner in Chief. The subtitle is Sidney Gottlieb and the CIA Search for Mind Control. And this ties back to one of the reasons why I'm so exercised about the military-industrial complex or the deep state or just a kind of body in a power base that exists on a kind of Cthulhu-type level of the ancient ones of, you know, in a Lovecraft sense, that pre-exists before we start loading up partisan politics or even particular strategies on top of this deep state. Poisoner in Chief about Sidney Gottlieb is about MK Ultra, this comic book program in the 1950s that the CIA introduced LSD and a wide variety of mind control agents. They were trying to figure out how they could change people's minds, unmask secret agents, embarrass or kill foreign leaders through dosing them surreptitiously with drugs. Gottlieb is a horrifying apparition who basically got off scot-free torturing American citizens, American soldiers, people in mental institutions, prisoners, and lived to testify about it. It implicates deeply people like Richard Helms, who is now long forgotten, but was a head of the CIA who destroyed all the evidence of his wrongdoing. And then even after things like the Church Commission and the Rockefeller Commission reports, it was like, okay, well, just go on a speaking tour, you know, and make a lot of money doing that and being a wise old man of American politics. So the book is Poisoner in Chief. It is a dark and disturbing look into the way that power operates in, you know, in 20th century America in ways that still, I think, inform how decisions get made, but rarely talked about. And just as a side note, if people liked Errol Morris's docudrama on Netflix series Wormwood, which is fantastic, you will find Gottlieb is one of the major figures in that as well. So this is, it's a peek into a very disturbing aspect of American political power.
We're two for two on tentacles in the recommendations so far.
That's right.
You guys can do
yes.
it.
Okay.
Suderman.
So I saw Uncut Gems, and it's one of the best movies I've seen of the year, but that's not what I want to talk about.
It's going to be tough
this
to make
year
tentacles
or
work.
Last
no.
year.
No. The book that I have been reading this last couple of days. So I want to start by saying I recently went through most of a bunch of the novels in our house, and then also was given an infusion of novels from my father, who was giving me in many cases books that he got from his father. Both my father and his father were English professors. So we just have this like giant collection of now of Suderman books going back several generations lying around the house that I've been in the process of organizing. And I started, of course, with the largest single category, which is fiction. And so I've been organizing all of that into a single space and trying to get it all roughly alphabetical and kind of been seeing what I have. And it's been really nice and wonderful kind of to connect with the books that I have, but also with the books that my father and his father read and talked about. And my dad, when he was here to drop them off, delivered like a lengthy Suderman-ish monologue about Bartleby the Scrivener, which got me thinking about Herman Melville. And so I have been reading Moby Dick.
Tentacles!
Tentacles, folks. I have been reading Moby Dick, and oh my goodness, it is so good. I'd never read Moby Dick before. We read Bartleby and we read Billy Budd when I was in high school. And I sort of paid attention to that. I really liked Bartleby the Scrivener, but I didn't care much for Billy Budd at the time. But Moby Dick is so wonderful. And I'm not even halfway through at this point, but it's just this great literate kind of super ecstatic American adventure about kind of finding yourself in the world and about, ambition and curiosity and self-knowledge and revenge and determination and the kind of the polyglot influences of, of America in the 1850s. And I just love it, guys. And it's got, there's definitely some tentacles in it.
I am not going to add to the tentacle porn that we've seen already on this podcast.
Why would you disappoint me like this, Matt?
Unless it just bubbles up from the surface. It always works. It always works. Crazy. I will. I was going to, since I go fourth, I get to use some discretion here. I was going to talk about what may well be our last ever Welsh household family movie night, because I'm going to need to get mediators from The Hague to stop the war crimes between certain members of the family as they go about the decision-making process, because we saw The Red Balloon, which
my
is,
God.
If you haven't seen that in a long time.
In a Franco-American household? Jesus, man.
That is, there are some interesting artifacts. But since no one else took it, I'm just going to say, I watched the Golden Globes last night, and Ricky Gervais' opening monologue is about, and also interjections, including a little Weinstein, Harvey Weinstein comment at the end, was so much more funny than every single person writing about it. I just want, that's, it's the mark of at least some comic ability. I was laughing a lot. My 11-year-old didn't quite understand why I was laughing with so much force. He was sending up a lot of Hollywood mores in a lot of, in some ways that were kind of surprising and hard to kind of follow. And it was just really funny. And the amount of people who are just like, oh, you think Ricky Gervais is funny, then you're not funny on Twitter. Holy cow, you people, you are not funny. You know who I'm talking about.
Australia is burning, Matt. Australia is burning. This is not a time for jokes at the Golden Globes.
It was terrific, and I dare say it planted a seed of even further contemporaneous miscomprehension expressed by the always crazy Joaquin Phoenix. So I think he felt challenged by Ricky Gervais's comment to not, tell the world about how it should behave, and so he then criticized people for using their own private jets to go to Palm Springs, which is a just a wonderful moment. But anyways, go watch the monologue if you haven't. It's really funny, and even if it's not as funny as I am describing it, which is not that funny, it's just so much better than the stupid anti-comedy scolds who are out there trying to tell you what isn't funny because they don't agree with its politics. And that's all the politics that you have to agree or disagree with in this week's Reason Roundtable podcast. Thank you for listening. Keep listening to all of our podcasts. Go to the reason.com/podcasts page to subscribe to the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie and Soho Forum Debates, Gene Epstein et al. And we'll catch you next week with hopefully not more war, but maybe some more war. Goodbye.
More tentacles, less war.
2020.